In the fifth lesson of this audio course on Lean UX, we look at the role that wireframes play in engaging stakeholders and ensuring a better deliverable. This course is free thanks to the support of Balsamiq. Hello and welcome to this audio course slash podcast slash rambling talk on Lean UX. This course is hosted by myself, Paul Boag, and Marcus Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. How are you this not very fine day? Has it stopped raining down your way?
It's quite sunny down here at the moment. It was raining earlier. Wow, it was raining earlier and it's really windy.
Yes, exactly. I know it sounds like typically Englishmen talking about the weather, but it was like proper weather. Like really kind of crazy. Bins blowing down the street weather.
But don't you think that all weather is proper weather these days? It's like it's nothing's halfway measures, is it? It's all like either hurricane
last podcast, I think.
yeah. It's global warming in action. Yeah,
exactly.
So that's fun. So, if we don't get destroyed by pandemics, we'll get destroyed by the environment instead. So how's life with you, Marcus?
I am just insanely bleh at the moment. I'm selling one house and trying to buy another one, and it's all very tricky. And, you know, and I need to get a bit of a mortgage, and it's, you know, I don't earn money in the way that most people do because I'm paid in various different ways, and it's just like my head's gonna explode basically.
Some things need some serious simplification, and taking buying houses full stop is just more complicated than it needs to be. Well, they need a user experience designer to sort the whole process out.
Well, I was kind of gazumped, and it, for anyone outside the UK or even outside England, that basically means that in England, unlike Scotland and probably the rest of the world, if somebody accepts your offer on their house, it's not binding. Basically, so someone else can come in and go, I'm going to give you a bit more, and they go, all right then, or they say no, I'm principled and I'm going to stick with my original offer. And this one, I kind of had that happen, but they were sort of semi principled, and then they came back to me saying, we want to stay with you because we said yes, but it's got so much higher now, would you be prepared to kind of meet halfway and all this kind of stuff?
One of those.
Yeah. So, something to simplify would be that when you accept a bid, it's binding. That would be a good place to start, wouldn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. But should we start off by just fixing the internet first?
Let's do that.
Before we start, you know, trying to apply user experience principles to every aspect of our lives, we could just try applying it to a website and see what happens. Just as an idea.
Yeah.
Which is what this whole season's about, usefully.
I know.
There you go. See how I transition there?
A true master at work.
I know, right. You could tell I've been doing this for far too long. So in the last episode, we looked at information architecture.
Yep.
This lesson, we're going to be looking at wireframing. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get a little collaborative a little talk from me about collaborative wireframing, should I say. Then we have an interview with Lee Howes from Headscape, who currently seems to be living in the 1940s with his radio voice. You'll see what I mean when you listen to the interview.
Lee is also selling one house and buying another house.
As you said in the interview, so we shall forgive him for his shitty mic. Yes. But it was really, we'll talk about it later anyway. Then we've got Michael from Balsamiq, who is talking about wire flows.
Ooh.
Is that a term you've heard, Marcus? No.
Is that creating a prototype, joining wireframes together?
Because I've got to do the interview with him later this afternoon. So at the moment, it's a big mystery.
Okay.
So after his talk, we're going to go, I'll say things like, wasn't that great and really enlightening without having a clue as to whether it was or not. So there we go. We'll do
I'm
that.
I'm looking forward to that the part last... of the show already.
I know. That's going to be by far the best bit. So there we go. What else did I want to say? Oh, I know what I wanted to say. I wanted to give a plug to the Boag World newsletter. I'm getting really into email newsletters these days. It's my new thing.
Okay.
You seem unconvinced, Marcus.
No, I think an email newsletter. Well, it's a funny one, isn't it? Depends what the subject is. It depends
who your audience is, I think.
I'm just trying to... my reaction to most newsletters that I've signed up for is just I ignore them. However, there are a few that I do pay a lot of attention to. So I think it's just the fact that you've signed up for it means that it's more likely to... You're more likely to connect with it.
That's the thing.
Social
right?
media.
The trouble with social media is it all just streams past you and you don't really see it.
Yeah.
The trouble with blog, I mean, I always used to, blogging was great for a long, long time with me because, you know, people would subscribe to a blog. Nobody subscribes to a blog now. People only look at a blog post if either it's been directly shared with them or they've searched on it via SEO. So, and I'm, you know, I like building communities and that kind of thing. So an email is a much better way of doing that. And I'm trying to reach a business-to-business audience who spend their whole lives in email anyway. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed it. It's allowed me, because I went through this stage with blogging where I was, like, writing the things that I knew people searched on, right? You know, so, I don't know. Well, like today, I've just released, you know, how to get more newsletter signups, ironically, as I'm promoting my newsletter, you know, because I know that's something people search on. But not all of the subjects I want to talk about are things that people are actually searching on and asking about, you know? So sometimes you want to be able to kind of go off on tangents and things like that, and an email lets you do that, so it's good. Anyway, if you want to sign up to my newsletter, go to boagworld.com/subscribe. It's a lot more than just my random ramblings on obscure subjects that nobody would search on. I also give away courses and books, and we've even got a referral program and a prize draw and all kinds of exciting things. So that's boagworld.com/subscribe. So shall we talk about wireframing?
Yes. So I was trying very hard to not say yours is one of the ones that I ignore, but it is.
You've said it. You said it now.
Well, that's not true. I'm being nasty for comic effect. I will flick through it, and if there's anything catches my eye, then I'll look at it. But generally speaking,
and that's all. Yeah, that's all that you can expect from anybody. You know. But I'm pleasantly surprised. Compared to the industry average, I get an open rate of just shy of 40%. Which is ridiculously high, and then a click-through rate of 6%, which again is very high. So, you know, I'm happy with that. It must be of some value to somebody.
Good.
Anyway, we're going to be talking about wireframing. Yeah. So let's kick off with a little talk where I talk about my approach to wireframing, how I feel it fits into the bigger picture, and why you really should be doing it with other people to get any significant value out of it. Okay, so I've got a confession to make. I love producing wireframes with my clients and the various stakeholders I work with. However, I am aware that I'm probably in the minority. For many designers, wireframing with stakeholders is to be avoided at all costs because it feels like it will end up with the client micromanaging the design. After all, what does your average stakeholder know about design anyway? Also, with such great prototyping tools out there these days, creating wireframes has fallen somewhat out of fashion, with designers instead leaning towards high-fidelity prototypes instead. But in today's podcast, I want to talk about wireframing, and I want to show you the value of creating wireframes and why you should get stakeholders involved in that process. And we begin by defining the difference between a wireframe and a prototype, just so we're all clear. There's no universally agreed definition of the difference between wireframes and prototypes. However, I think it's generally accepted that wireframes are lower fidelity than prototypes. Also, wireframes are typically standalone pages, while a prototype consists of interconnected pages that can be navigated at least in some form or another. What this means in practice is that wireframes tend to be faster to produce and require fewer design skills than prototyping does. They also are often nothing more than sketches of content boxes that appear on a page. However, sometimes they're slightly higher definition and are produced with a tool like Balsamiq, but generally speaking, they're often hand-drawn. All of this is to say that anybody can produce a wireframe. That makes it an excellent tool for engaging with clients and stakeholders in the creation process. Of course, you might be wondering why you would want to include the stakeholder in the first place. So let's talk about that for a minute. More than likely, you've had a bad experience in the past with a client interfering in the design process. Nothing is more frustrating than losing control of your design and then getting the blame when things don't perform particularly well. You may have been unfortunate enough to actually endure design by committee, which is the kind of extreme version of this problem, where a group of stakeholders debate and discuss the design direction, reducing you to really nothing more than a pixel pusher. But the approach I'm proposing when it comes to wireframing will avoid either of these scenarios. It will also provide you with a lot of benefits, not least of which is the fact that you will be able to uncover design directions that you might have otherwise missed. When all you need is a pen, some paper, and a few seconds to sketch something out, it can be very liberating. It lets you explore many more approaches than, say, something like prototyping would allow. The exercises I carry out with my stakeholders and my clients encourages the production of a wide variety of wireframes, tackling the problem from lots of different angles. We'll produce wireframes aimed at different user groups, different levels of expertise, and with the emphasis on different business objectives or brand values. The aim is to generate as many ideas as possible. And once you've established a wide variety of approaches, you can refine and discard and combine them until you have two or three that work. It would be impossible to explore the number of different approaches in any other way than wireframing. And so it works really well for that. And it also provides you with an opportunity to encourage the whole team to work together and get involved. You see, wireframing shouldn't just be the responsibility of a designer or user experience expert. It should be something that everybody participates in. I regularly bring together designers, developers, project managers, and whoever else is involved in the project to wireframe important functionality. And that's valuable because it improves team working and helps each member to understand the role of the others. It's also an excellent way of breaking down that kind of waterfall model of running projects where each team member effectively just throws their work off to the next person over the wall. These group wireframing sessions improve not only team working, but also general communication. You see, many organizations suffer from not involving stakeholders, such as developers, early enough in the process, and that leads to functionality being promised that's difficult to, or impossible to build. By including everybody in the wireframing process, this problem is eliminated. A developer, for example, will quickly spot issues in a wireframe that would be missed if it was buried in an email thread or some functional specification. That's the beauty of wireframes. Because they're visual, it's all so much easier to grasp what's being proposed. Specification documents and emails are okay, but they are harder to visualize and perceptions can vary. Wireframes leave much less room for misunderstanding. Of course, wireframes is not just about improving communication skills with your developer, they also improve communication with all of your stakeholders. And engaging your stakeholders throughout a project is critical to a project's success, and that's especially true when it comes to things like design. A stakeholder who has seen a wireframe and has been allowed to provide feedback is much more likely to sign off the final design. However, don't stop at just allowing them to provide some feedback. Actively involve them in the creation of wireframes. The more a stakeholder is involved in the creation of a design, the more sense of ownership they have over it. The more they feel they own it, the more likely they are to approve it and even defend it to others. Most importantly of all, they understand the design. By getting stakeholders involved in its creation, you get a chance to educate them. Finally, involving stakeholders will flush out issues earlier in the process that when it's a lot more straightforward to change things. The earlier you can identify and address issues in a digital project, the better. For a start, everyone is less attached to the direction and so more willing to change. But also, the cost of changing things becomes progressively higher the further into a project you get. Because wireframes are quick and easy to produce, it costs nothing to discard them and try another approach. And this willingness to change makes us much more responsive to the results of things like user testing and feedback from stakeholders. Also, because the developer was involved in the creation of the wireframes, you can avoid things like costly functionality mistakes where you commit yourself to a particular path. The same is also true when it comes to testing. Although simple to create and, well, very simple in their design, it's entirely possible to test wireframes with users to see if the fundamental approach will work or not. And later I'm going to cover exactly how to go about doing that. However, for now, what's worth noting is that because wireframes are easy to create and produce at the very start of the design process, any test findings can be easily implemented without incurring additional costs or causing the project to slip. So, hopefully by now you can see the advantages of creating wireframes and doing so with stakeholders. Now let's look at exactly how we're going to put that into practice. First of all, we need to be realistic. Running a full-day workshop dedicated to wireframing is going to leave you and all your participants exhausted. So in my experience, 3 hours is about the right amount to do for wireframing in one sitting. The advantage of keeping these sessions relatively short is that it's much easier to keep the momentum going. And the idea isn't necessarily to hammer down every detail, but rather to create a general direction and an agreement on direction that you can refine outside of the workshop. You can maintain momentum by running several short exercises, and each exercise should build on the one before to take you closer to something tangible. So remember that when you're doing a wireframing workshop, your aim is to establish any issues with the direction you intend to take, make people feel included and engaged in the process, educate the client and other stakeholders, and ensure that everyone has the same vision of what you're trying to achieve. So it helps to go into the workshop with a list of the main pages you want to wireframe, and that will normally include more complex or divisive pages such as the home page, landing pages, etc. Now, I recommend prioritizing your list of different pages you want to tackle so that if you don't get to them all, then you've at least tackled the most important ones. So, with that list in hand, here's a few exercises I tend to cycle through for each page that we need to address. I usually start by working on the critical messaging that the website or the particular page needs to communicate. It's surprising how often stakeholders and clients can't articulate the most basic information they need to communicate, information such as what the organization does or how that benefits the user or how it delivers on those benefits. Instead, they just want to throw everything online and let the user work it out. So to address these kind of fundamentals, I set aside the website for a moment and asked the stakeholders in attendance to design a book jacket. Now, the reason I choose a book jacket is that it's got physical constraints that limit the amount of content and forces the group to prioritize. They have to consider what goes on the front, the back, the spine, and the inside flap of the book jacket, with different regions having different prominence and roles. For example, the spine is about grabbing user attention, while the cover is the main message that you need to communicate, and so on and so on. This exercise will force the group to articulate their value proposition in a prioritized, clear manner. And the book jacket exercise will become a solid starting point. That said, sooner or later, you need to turn your attention to the site itself. So when I do turn my attention to the website, I begin by getting people to suggest every element that could or should appear on the particular page for wireframing. The idea is to get everything out there without worrying about how relevant or otherwise the idea is. And I do this because pretty much everybody in the room is going to have an agenda. Stakeholders have something they want to see on the page or that they want to be promoted on the site as a whole. And if you prevent the stakeholders from expressing these desires, they're going to leave the room frustrated, and so they're going to be much more less likely to support the final approach. Now, If it's a small group, then all we do is shout out ideas and I write them up on a whiteboard. However, if there's a bigger session, I tend to split people down into smaller groups and make it competitive. I encourage each group to come up with as many elements as they possibly can to put on a particular page, and I offer a prize at the end of it. So I suggest to them to break, you know, larger elements such as headers down into components like logo, navigation, search bar, etc., because that creates more elements and gives them a better chance of winning. And then the winning group gets something like a box of chocolates they can share. It's not unusual for a group to come up with 40 plus items for a particular page. And by making the exercise fun, you're kind of setting the tone of the workshop and the tough decisions they're about to have to make in the next exercise, which is the user attention point exercise. Now, the user attention point exercise is actually a pretty simple one. You explain to your audience that users have limited attention. You therefore assign the page that you're wireframing 24 points of user attention. Now, don't get too hung up on it being 24. If it's a few more, it really doesn't matter. Each element the group adds to the page costs a single point. But if they want the user to pay more attention to one particular element over another, like, for example, the primary call to action over the cookie policy, then you'll need to give it more user attention points. Now, the group's natural inclination will be to cram as many of their items that they came up with as possible onto the page, spending one or maximum of 2 points on each piece of content. And the result is going to be a really busy design. So when they've done that, I tend to ask them which website they find more useful in their opinion, the Yahoo homepage or the Google homepage. Then I show them it. And people inevitably pick Google. I then show the two side by side and point out that the Google has spent the vast majority of its user attention points on the search box, and while Yahoo, by comparison, has spread it all over the place. And that typically helps people to start focusing on where they spend their points. And you can repeat the exercise again and get them to make tougher decisions this time round. Now, by the end of the exercise, you're going to have a clear indication of where the priorities are for any particular page and what is the most important things on those pages. However, that doesn't mean you shouldn't explore other approaches. And for that, we try out something called the six up exercise. Now, this exercise is about encouraging experimentation. It's an exercise people do individually, although it can work in small groups too. You take a sheet of paper and you fold it in half vertically and then in thirds horizontally. So you end up with six boxes, basically. Each person or group now has to create six different versions of the page in question. Each little sketch in the little box that they've created is going to be incredibly simple, but it's a way to explore different ways that you could design the page. Participants will quite easily come up with one, possibly two versions, but then they're going to begin to struggle. Coming up with six proposals will be an effort, and they'll probably need some advice, like try producing versions of a page aimed at different audiences or with an emphasis on different value propositions, that kind of thing. There are two reasons for this exercise. First, it does occasionally uncover some interesting approaches that you won't have considered. However, more importantly, it shows the stakeholders there's no one perfect approach. And so the one that they've got in their heads, because most people do have a vague vision of what the site should look like in their heads, isn't necessarily the best one and certainly isn't the only one. So you're kind of educating the client at the same time here. And in fact, notice that all the exercises I've outlined have been about prioritizing and educating people rather than producing final wireframes. Yes, the exercise will provide some valuable content to work with, but it won't constrain you to a particular approach. And that's the key thing. It still falls to you to produce the final design. However, when you do, you're going to find it much easier to win over stakeholders because they felt like they've been involved and also they'll be better educated. That said, some testing will never hurt in reinforcing your case with any particularly difficult stakeholders. Even though wireframing is basically static images with no interaction, you can still do testing with end users. Doing so is a great way to flag potential issues early on, but it's also a great way of building up a case to present to stakeholders for your chosen design approach. Best of all, testing wireframes is quick and inexpensive, and there are two straightforward exercises you can perform starting with the first click test. A first click test involves asking a user to indicate what they would click on if they were trying to complete a particular task, okay? And this is based on the fact that there's been research carried out that if users get their first click correct, they've got an 87% chance of completing the entire action correctly, as opposed to just 46% if they get the first click wrong. So this kind of test is ideal for discovering whether users understand the navigation of a particular wireframe you're testing. Now, the second test you can run is something called a five-second test. So as the name applies, you show the user a page for 5 seconds and ask them to recall what they've seen. Try to pay particular attention not only to what elements they remember, but also the order in which they remember them. Elements that were very prominent in the user's minds will be mentioned first. And that can be useful as a test to ascertain whether people have seen the critical page elements that you want them to see and whether that matches the priorities that you set in something like the user attention point exercise. Both of these tests can be done in person. However, to be honest, it's often easier to run them as a survey using a tool like Usability Hub. Not only does usabilityhub.com, I think it is, support both of these tests, they'll also even recruit participants for you for as little as $1 per person. So hopefully now you can see the value of creating wireframes and that you should be doing it with stakeholders rather than by yourself. And by adopting this approach, you will end up with better digital services, but you'll also avoid costly mistakes, have happier, better educated stakeholders, and have a strong case to support your design direction. Yes, I know it can be tempting to jump straight into something like Figma and start working on a design. And yes, I know it feels like wireframing will slow the process down. However, in the vast majority of cases, it's time well spent. It will actually improve the final deliverable and avoid getting stuck in revision hell. So what did you think of this one, Marcus?
I wrote lots of notes like a good student. I kind of felt that you talked a lot about the inputs, how to get the inputs to input into wireframing, which is no bad thing. And it kind of that sat well because Lee talked a lot about the actual process of wireframing. So the two go quite nicely together, hopefully that's what people will think when they get around to listening to that. But a few things.
I mean, it's interesting. It's an interesting one because I've got to say, I not disagree, that's a strong word, but I take a very different approach to wireframing to Lee.
Mm.
But I think what we need to do is we need to listen to your interview with Lee first, and then we'll talk about some of the differences, because I think that's really interesting. How about that? Does that sound like a plan?
Spot on.
Okay, let's listen to Lee then.
Okay then, so this week, as I'm sure Paul's just introduced, we have Lee Howells on the show as my interviewee. And as long-time listeners of the podcast will probably remember, Lee has kind of been the third host over the years, where he's imparted his wisdom on things like UX and UI design. Hello, Lee.
Hello, Marcus. How are you?
I'm all right. As we were just discussing before we got on to here, both of us are moving house at the moment, so we're really stressed and probably...
Yes.
This will either be the best interview ever or it'll be a waste of time.
Stressed and in utter chaos with literally everything.
Yes. I know the feeling, because I just thought by now everything will be fine. It's getting worse. I'll go mad. But yeah, one day normality will return.
I'm sitting in a room that looks not dissimilar to Howard Carter's discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb, with literally things all over the place in utter madness and no order. And I'm glad this isn't a video podcast. It isn't, is it? It's not. Tell me it's not.
It's not. Are you doing... I hope you're throwing away lots of things.
Yes, I have probably done 12 tip runs. Of course, it's extra complicated now because you have to book them all, which is all right, pay. And I think I might have slightly fractured a wrist trying to get things into the skip, over the edge.
Ooh,
so that isn't helping
anything. A slight
anything.
Fracture. Well, that's a sprain, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. It's one of those things. I've never broken a bone or fractured a bone, so I do know this feels different to anything, but it's not unbearable, so I can't have broken it. It's probably a sprain.
You can have very, very small sort of hairline cracks and things.
Yeah, that you I didn't bang it or rest, anything. It was just like repeated.
Yeah, don't lift anything else heavy.
Repeated two heavy things. It's kind of throbbing and a bit creaky. Mm. Sort of heavy feeling.
Okay. Anyway, let's move on.
Yes.
Because there are more opportunities, or I'm going to give you more opportunities for going off piste and annoying Paul. But to start off with, as we've already explained, this week we're talking about, or the theme of today's subject is low fidelity wireframing with stakeholders. And this comes under the whole banner of the series where we're talking about how to do lean UX effectively, or how to do UX design quickly or on a budget, you know, as effectively and as usefully as you can. And bearing in mind, Lee is the person who is nearly always the one creating wireframes on the fly during client workshops. It's just been assumed over the years that's what you do, right? Yes, Lee will be there to kind of like pull it all in together with the stakeholders. So I couldn't think of anyone better qualified to talk about this subject. So anyways, as I said, everyone gets 5 minutes to talk a bit about themselves and go off on tangents that have nothing at all to do with web design, again to annoy Paul. So well, firstly, maybe just obviously not everybody knows you because you haven't been on the show for quite a while. So a little bit of background about how you ended up doing what you're doing, and maybe just another couple of minutes on what's been sort of front of mind for you lately.
Apart from moving. Okay. Well, how did I end up in the web design world? It's the typical path, isn't it? Typical path: degree in geography, master's in music technology, first job in a charity, then seeing an advert for web designer in a local paper, and that's where I first got in touch with Paul. So I created a portfolio on a floppy disk, 1.4 megabytes, and it was like this kind of extracting thing. Did all these whizzy animations and stuff, and I'd only done web design for a university at the time, so it was really making a big deal out of not very much. And went for an interview with Paul, showed him various printouts of stuff I'd done. He didn't give a damn, didn't even know I'd even got a degree in anything or a master's in anything. He just saw this stuff and took me on. So that's the obvious path into web design that a lot of us have had, sort of ended up in it.
You started in the Wild West at the same time I did.
Yeah. It was very wild back then. But it was new to everybody.
Now people have actual qualifications.
I know.
Yeah, the stuff we do.
But no doubt there's a Wild West that people are doing in a similar way in some other area that isn't mainstream yet. It's just starting. Don't know what that is. Perhaps it's recycling lithium batteries or something weird like that, some kind of future thing that we'll all be doing before we know it. So 20 years of web design later, here I am, the man who does the wireframes in kickoffs. I didn't always do the wireframe. I do remember other people usually did it when it was on flip charts, because we started, well, first of all, we didn't do any wireframing at all in the early noughties. That was I don't think it had been thought of back then. We just did a mock-up. We did a Photoshop mock-up, flat graphic, here you go. everything in a picture. IA, calls to action, look and feel, structure, there it all was. In a picture, quite often printed out.
Printed out. Three different versions, obviously.
Yeah, three different versions, and then a salesperson would disappear and then come back a week later saying, can you just change this, this, and this? And that was usually it. Done. Build mode.
That's it. Now go and build without any questions about how this is going to work.
Absolutely.
Being asked.
And so you'd start laying out your tables.
Yeah, so quite early on, we realised that that wasn't a very good way to start a project.
Yeah.
So we started doing wireframing. I can remember, and to a certain extent still do this sometimes, wireframing on, pen and paper, many, 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 many different page types and you know, scribbling over them where ideas would change and all that kind of thing. But that's not how you do it these days. How do you approach wireframing your stakeholders now?
After lots of scribbling things out and being quite frustrated by it all, I just started using, I think it was probably when Balsamiq first came out, started trying to use Balsamiq because it made everything look sketchy and hand-drawn, and it was quick to drag things on and do it on the fly in the workshop, which was just less messy. I know there's a lovely, tangible idea of pen and paper, but can you just move this over there? I mean, often redrawing the whole thing or being really confused by what's going on with arrows. Any words, you ended up just kind of scribbling things that you couldn't read. So it just made a lot more sense to type things, draw things in a non-destructive or a destructive way that you can move around and reposition more easily.
Yeah.
And that's how I've done it ever since. Just because it's quicker. And people say, do this on paper, it's really quick. But I don't think it is this quick. I think doing it on the screen is much, much quicker and easier and clearer for everybody.
I like pen and paper because it feels like I'm still in brainstorm mode. It doesn't matter so much. But and this is just me, I think. As soon as it's sort of like I open a computer up and start working on screen, that it's like I have to get it right more quickly somehow. But you've always been
I think
less bothered about that.
Yeah, I think it depends how you're used to doing things. I've heard, psychological kind of discussions about different states of mind using different mediums like pen and paper and digital, but I suppose I've always used digital, really, because using pen and paper usually frustrates me because things aren't lining up and things are messy and scruffy. I want it all to be neat and tidy, so I think better digitally than on paper. And I even when it comes down to writing, they say, if you're writing things by hand, it goes into your brain better. I don't think it does because I'm so slow at writing. I'd rather type. And that goes into my brain much more directly than writing ever will.
I've now developed a form of joined up capital writing.
Joined up capitals?
Ooh.
Yeah, because joined up lowercase, I can't read. It looks like a five-year-old's written it, but my capital writing is quite nice, but I now do it joined up.
I think this might be part of my problem, because when I've analysed my handwriting, I don't think I join up. I think I join up about two or three combinations of letters, and everything else is a single letter. So because my handwriting is so slow, I think that's part of the frustration. I'd much rather type and draw on screen than use paper.
Do you think, while we're on this subject, do you think that clients, stakeholders in the room feel comfortable about diving straight into, there's a guy here who's kind of drawing our ideas electronically rather than maybe there's an expectation of doing stuff on a whiteboard or on sheets of paper?
Well, that's a very good question. No one's ever said that before. I don't know. I never thought about what they expected. I'd always kind of assumed and hoped that they thought this was a better solution, because they could see, they can see it looking. First of all, physically, they can see it on a big screen. Depending on the size of the room, everybody can see it, and you can zoom in and things like that, rather than some scrappy writing on a flipboard or a whiteboard. It's interesting. I've never known what their expectations were or if I've differed from it, so I don't know.
I found over the years that people love this element of a web design project, that they really enjoy these kind of initial sketches, because that's what they are. What we're talking about here is whether they should be literal sketches or kind of analog sketches versus digital ones. And I guess where I think I'm going with this is, I'm going to big you up. I think you're very quick at putting the ideas down and adjusting them as the conversation changes. And I think you need someone like that, because if it was me sort of like trying to get Balsamiq or whatever working, then I'd be slower than if I was doing it on paper. So I think that's the key here, and you're really good at it. So I think that's why it works. But it's just, you mustn't lose the element of kind of like, this is fun, because I think pretty much anyone in a situation doing this, it is fun. It's brainstorming, which is great.
Yeah, I would hope that me doing it on screen, if it's not what they expect, it's perhaps better than what they were expecting. Mm. If they were expecting someone to be drawing things on a whiteboard, it's more fun on screen. And yeah, I kind of listen to all the conversations and I'm editing things on the fly and sort of showing what that strand of the conversation might look like if they did that. So, you know, we can always keep it really dynamic rather than trying to draw. If I'm drawing things on paper, I find it harder to listen. I can kind of listen whilst doing things on screen a bit more easily, although that's still a bit tricky, yeah. To be honest.
Yeah, I think that one of the key things that I've taken from us doing working in these ways over the last however many years, 5, 10 years even now, is that you need somebody who's very competent at using whatever package you're using, because you change your package all the time. I'll ask about that in a minute. Also being able to keep up and understand what's important from the conversations that are going on. And I'd say that's, I think, probably one of the most important aspects of somebody who is doing low fidelity wireframing with stakeholders, as the title of this particular episode is. So, yes, let's go on to what sort of thing do you use? What packages? You mentioned Balsamiq, which obviously the Balsamiq people will be very pleased about because they sponsored this entire series. But what else do you use?
I think I made a list earlier of all the things I've used. I'm not sure if it was just before Balsamiq, but I remember sitting in a workshop and I decided at the last minute to use Flash Catalyst, which you've probably never even heard of.
I don't know what that is.
It was a kind of obscure Adobe tool, which I hadn't used it before the workshop for more than 10 minutes. It turned out to be quite a bad idea, but it did all the kind of rollover things joining things up with each other, which I don't think Balsamiq could do at the time. And it seemed like a really great idea. I think it was something to do with drawing out Flash apps at the time. I think it was discontinued in 2012, so I didn't continue using it. But yeah, never a good idea to choose a new tool just before their workshop. And I have done that quite a few times, I must admit.
I was going to say, that's pretty much a constant for you, Lee.
It's like, oh, this will be much better. That's a great idea. Yeah, I'll have a quick practice, like 10 minutes, and then you get into the workshop and you suddenly realise, oh, no, it doesn't do that. Oh, damn it. Still, stick with it. Yeah, so Flash Catalyst, Balsamiq, Axure, which is still pretty good.
Axure, yep.
It's one of the best tools for drawing a box and clicking on and being able to immediately type in it. Lots of tools. You have to draw a box and then click something else to make some words appear inside it, which is independent of the box, which is quite annoying. Axure is great for clicking a box and instantly having words. Sketch, Adobe XD, Vision Studio, Figma is the latest one. And that's really because that's my main design tool now. It's not sketchy like Balsamiq is. But I find I probably know that tool best now, so it makes sense to keep it safe with the tool you know the best, really, and it's really, really fast and you can join everything together. So that's the one I use mostly now until the next thing comes along tomorrow.
Yes. I'm going to park that one there. Let's move on to my next question, which is, a lot of your wireframes are the kind of start of your design process, but let's say I'm doing the wireframing, and I'm going to pass that on to you. How important is layout, or how annoying is my layout or my interpretation of layout when we're wireframing?
Well, you see, we mostly wireframe now the mobile view first, which, if you're not careful, is a boring list of things.
That was my next question. Yeah, what about mobile?
Well, it's kind of fundamental now, because that's usually all we get to do in the workshops, trying to identify what's on the key pages we've decided on, and really important to get those prioritized, which of course the mobile narrow single column view has to do. So we used to do an exercise where we would literally do kind of list of content in priority order for a page, and that's effectively what the mobile view is now. And I think a lot of workshop attendees would rather you were doing a desktop layout, but that kind of really should come later. That's about as a luxury to get onto if you can start deciding where things are going to go in a wide page view. And usually it's more important for us to get those priorities on the single column pages worked out first.
Okay, that's really interesting, because I guess I'm harking back to the time when I used to do a lot more wireframing, and because that was a time when kind of desktop view was pretty much everyone's view of a website, that I still view wireframing as designing for desktop. But
yeah,
you're basically saying no, don't do that, because so layout is not important. Effectively, we're looking at developing prioritized lists of content. That's what wireframe.
Yeah,
is.
It's interesting. It depends very much on the work we're doing. If we're providing a design first and foremost, where that's quite often is presenting somebody with a mobile view first of a design isn't really what they're expecting. So you kind of have to do both, but really they want to see the desktop first. Yeah, they want to see them both ideally at the same time, but really in their hearts they want to see how it's going to look on their laptop or desktop machine rather than their mobile, because that's just how they seem to think. But if we're starting from wireframing, so the client may have done some wireframing, or it might be a kind of refresh of a design or something like that for this desktop first approaching the design. But if we're starting the whole process, we'll be wireframing at mobile and doing the desktop as a kind of enhancement from that. So they need to, the expectation needs to be set the other way around for that kind of approach.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think that it's a very important point that you're making, that really wireframing actually is about prioritization of content, and it's not about drawing pictures of home pages. Maybe that's part of the process, but it's not a very massively important part.
No, very rarely do a home page. That's not what we wireframe, unless it's really pushed for, because that's just spend forever on the home page.
Let's wrap up with what do you think is the most important thing for somebody in your position doing this kind of work? If you're preparing for, or you're just kicking off that session with stakeholders, what's the most important thing in your opinion?
Do you know what? I think the most important thing is this will sound silly, but apart from being well practiced in what you're doing, because there's going to be a room full of people looking at you, I've always found it, the pressure isn't quite as high if you're furthest away from the screen, because everyone's looking the other way. Everyone's looking towards the screen. Mm. My best workshops ever have been where I've been at the end of the table and they've been looking at the other way, because it just, the pressure's quite high when you're there. You know what it's like just typing when people are watching you. You're drawing boxes and laying things out and typing. It can all get a bit stressful. So, If the wires are long enough, and that's usually the problem. It's usually the wires. take a 5 meter HDMI cable with you. If you can get yourself comfortable for that kind of high pressure situation, then it's just gonna make it easier, make it more fun for you.
I wasn't expecting that, and a superb response. So I'm gonna give you one more. So if you've got one sort of final tip, which is maybe more related to the actual process, what would that be?
Okay. So quite often I don't worry about the sort of actual contents of the header and footer so much, because they can take down rabbit holes away from the pages you're trying to get to the bottom of. So I've got a big grey block that says header, a big grey block that says footer. Unless there's kind of specific navigation that we're going to start worrying about at that point. But again, navigation can be a rabbit hole that can take what we've done. We've done two-day workshops just on navigation before. So, if you want to eat your time up and it's needing a lot of discussion, kind of park that for a different part of the process. But keep some of those trickier areas as kind of big grey blocks. Header here. So we don't get worried about the logo, okay. The size of the logo, the sort of strap line position, everything else. Don't worry about it.
Well, thank you very much, Lee. Thanks for your time.
That's quite all right. Thank you, Marcus.
So now people understand why I said he sounded like a 1940s radio presenter. It was really weird. It went from like him sounding perfectly fine to suddenly being all crackly and weird.
I think he was very using, because I had the conversation with him, right, you ready for, I think it was in half an hour. Are you ready in half an hour? And it was like, shit, I forgot about it, blah, blah, blah. Can we do it tomorrow? No, I said. And then he said, okay, well, let's do it this afternoon. I'll see if I can find a mic. And I think that was a kind of old headset where you used to have the mic on the wire. You know,
as soon as
he moved his head, it went into a different mode, and then strange sort of radio voice, and then he'd come back normal again. So, sorry, peeps, about the audio quality, but that's Lee for you.
Well, it was good content. Yeah, it was good content, and we'll let him off because he's, you know, he's done lots of good stuff before, so that's fine. And what he said was really good.
Yeah.
So what I did like, I thought. It was encouraging to hear him buck the trend of pen and paper, right? Because, you know, you hear so much pretentious crap about pen and paper and how wonderful it is and freeing and liberating and all that kind of stuff. And I pretty much said the same thing in my session. And I will explain to you why I take a different point of view over that. But I thought it was really great. He said, well, actually, it's a lot easier to change things and undo things and, you know, and move things around in a tool than it is anything else. So I thought that was really good.
I can remember you and I doing wireframes on, you know, with pen and paper, where we'd cut bits out of another bit of paper to stick it over the top. And it's like, well, you know, because the previous bit was wrong and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So yes, he has the point. It's just, he's just really competent using tools like that. And another major thing is that you can stick it on a big screen rather than some horrible drawing that no one can know from the other side of the table can see. I was going to say one of the things that I just mustn't forget from your talk. One of the things that I felt was really really good from your talk was this idea that this whole process is a chance to educate, and that it creates the right ethos throughout the rest of the project. And that's not something I'd ever thought of before. If you get everybody involved early on, and you know, we all know that it's good to get the stakeholders' input so they feel like they're bought in, blah 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 blah. But it teaches them the value of it for the rest of the project, and that's the kind of what I really took from what you were saying, Paul.
To be honest, I think it's that. That is the main takeaway for me of wireframing, because if you're honest, right, you could skip straight to some kind of prototyping stage and do something a bit more high fidelity and get just stuck in. All the client really needs to do, as you pretty much concluded, was a prioritized list. Mm-hmm. So wireframes aren't strictly relevant from that point of view. For me, it's that wireframing is an engagement tool and a way of educating clients. And that's maybe why I have a slight problem with the kind of Lee approach of doing it, which is that he's one person sitting there transcribing other people's ideas, right? Mm-hmm. So only one person can drive the process, which to some degree limits other people's involvement a little bit. While the kind of approach that I was taking was, well, let's do a series of exercises. Everybody scribbles stuff down. Everybody gets involved. Everybody can kind of learn through the process. And it's a much more kind of interactive process than, you know, maybe the way Lee described it. But that could just be because it's been a very long time since I've sat in a session that Lee's run doing this kind of thing. So I guess it depends how many stakeholders you've got as well.
Well, I mean, it's just simply a case. Remember right at the start of this, I said that what I took from your talk was that it was more about the kind of pre-wireframing. I felt it's what you were talking about, and Lee was talking about the actual wireframing. The pre-wireframing stuff is, I mean, we do the designer serial box rather than the book jacket, though I prefer book jacket, and I'm going to change to book jacket. because the spine it has a different meaning. I really like that. It's kind of like a special view.
Yeah.
So, and six up and all that kind of thing, along with all the, your kind of IA type exercises, which are let's break off into groups and then come back and list all the things we've learned. And then we're now going to do some interactive wireframing, which is interactive from the point of view. We're going to talk about stuff while Lee puts down those ideas in something that you can kind of view as some sort of web page, whether it be mobile or it seems to be all mobile these days. It's been a while since I've actually sat in one of these sessions. It's kind of like we definitely do a lot of those kind of hands-on exercises, but the actual process of designing whatever, you know, very very broad sense pages, again quite broad sense, is something that Lee will pull together
I think that's quite an art. I don't think even I would want to, well, I would do a push, but I would prefer to go away and think about it and sit down and design that rather than do it in the room. But I guess that's one of the advantages to constraining it just to mobile to begin with, because you're not trying to work out complicated layouts with different, you know, weightings of different content in different places. You're just creating essentially that prioritized list. So I actually think that's a pretty good move if you're going to start wireframing to that degree in the room with the client.
It does depend on the client a lot. I mean, we had a kickoff meeting, must be last year now. My sense of time has completely gone. I have no idea what decade we're in even. I think it must be last year now, where we did some a wireframing exercise with a client, which just didn't work. And I think it's because we probably didn't have enough inputs, or the kind of the data that we'd got from the exercises was still a little bit in the air. So it wasn't like everyone was kind of pushing in the same direction. So the wireframing exercise just didn't work. Other times you can kind of start looking at quite complicated layouts, because you one of your exercises is the idea of, you know, you have a certain number of points you can spend. So if people do that well, then you are able to make design decisions off the back of what they've given you. So yeah, it depends on what you've got to work with, I suppose.
I think the other area that I was a little bit unsure about whether I agreed with Lee it is over wireframing key pages like the homepage. I totally agree with his logic behind it, in the sense that it will be a time sink. And I thought what he said about navigation was a great idea. Look, just don't touch it. But when it comes to things like homepages, I'm more inclined to kind of confront that challenge there and then. He's totally right. It's a nightmare. But the reason I think I would focus on that initially is because it gives the client a chance to, or the stakeholders a chance to get it out of their system, because they've all got stuff they want on the homepage. They've all got things they want to say. And so I'm actually a fan of, well, let's just let them say it. Let's get it all into the open. Let's have that conversation while things are relatively easy to sort out, rather than wait for further down the line. But I guess it depends on how much time you've got, doesn't it, really?
It kind of does. And actually, I agree with you on that. And I think the last two or three sessions that Lee's done haven't been with me. So we'll come back in and I'll be listing content that could or should be on the homepage. Because I think that from a political point of view, it's a good thing to do. I know what he means. So if you've got, you know, 10 key pages, and that's maybe too many, but let's say there's half a dozen key pages you want to, get into the detail on over, say, an afternoon, the homepage will just take the whole afternoon. So he is right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I guess, again, this comes down to how much detail, how much wireframing you do in the room and how much is just exercises to make the client feel engaged. I think that's the big difference, really, between Lee's approach and my approach. And my approach is really about client management. It's about client education. It's about making them feel involved. Mm. Lee's approach is much more, okay, I want to get a tangible wireframe that I can base the design upon, right? And I think that dictates, you know, which of those is most appropriate in your situation really kind of dictates how much wireframing you do in the room. And that dictates which, you know, which templates you would do in the room and that kind of thing. Because I think from my point of view, really, I wouldn't even try and, you know, wireframe six elements in a, you know, in a sitting, six pages in a sitting, because I know that actually the majority of the people in the room don't care about six different templates. They just care about the home page and a couple of others, you know? So it kind of depends on what your aim is and how you're using them. And actually, I think that's what's been really good about this episode is that you have got two very different approaches to the same problem, which is always very interesting.
Mm. Marvelous.
Anyway, let's find out what wire flows are, because I am fascinated to hear this. I only wish I had I could know for when we finish this this segment, but here we go. Here is my future self talking to the future Michael about the future of Wireflows. So today we've got Michael from Balsamiq joining us. Hello, Michael.
Hi, how you doing?
It's good to have you on the show. Now, me and Marcus were literally just having a conversation about this segment and trying to work out what wire flows are, because that's what you're going to be talking to us about today. And it's not a term that either of us had come up, you come across before. So why don't you kick off by telling us what wire flows are and how that compares with wireframes?
Right. So wireflows are this sort of hybrid document that combines some of the function of user flows, task flows, and flow charting, where you're meant to diagram sort of how the user will progress through a task, how the system logic reacts to the user moving through the task, and wireframing so that you can sort of merge the visual design requirements with some of the business and system logic to complete tasks. Okay. So this is an idea that that just was coined by someone at Nielsen Norman Group, but it's been sort of something that's been evolving by designers.
Now, that's fascinating. So I've completely missed this. This is one of those things, you know, there's so many techniques and different approaches that go around, and this one has bypassed me entirely. I like the sound of it, mine, but tell me a little bit more about what the benefits are, why you would choose to use this over, I don't know, building a full prototype, for example.
Right. So the benefits to using this is that you stay low fidelity and sort of do a lot of idea generation without buying into an idea too soon. So, you know, generally when you're talking about something at the level of a task flow, you start with words and you can just sort of flesh out where the user will go when trying to complete a task, and then just do a very simple wireframe that represents that. Simple enough that it can be disposed of if you need to change your idea and go in another direction. So without having to go too far down a path and invest time into prototyping, you get the benefit of fast idea generation at this stage.
So from the sounds of it, this isn't. It's not actually a clickable prototype where you go from page to page. It's a visualization of the journey instead.
Right. I mean, what we tended to do earlier, I mean, maybe like 20 years ago for me, I was doing a lot more storyboarding, like just sort of separate documents where it was maybe a flow chart that represented all of these flows, and then sort of designing discrete screens that show each screens change the state. And this just sort of merged that flow into the wireframe document so that you see branching off of the single UI, you know, the dynamic parts and how they change. So it's really become, it's become a little bit more of like a diagram than just a UI design.
I guess it also has the advantage that it keeps the wireframes low fidelity, because to be able to see this whole thing within one visual, you can't start over engineering your wireframes so they end up really detailed and you end up building a high fidelity prototype. So it's quite good from that point of view as well, I guess.
Yeah. I think where this really picked up speed is we saw a lot of people doing this when mobile smartphone design started to happen in the single canvas. And we saw designers really take off with this idea of putting it all in one canvas and seeing it all at once like this.
So how do you go about using these wire flows? What's their main usage?
When we're doing feature design on our product, we tend to we look at the core functions that we're designing in the feature, and then we might break out the dynamic parts of the screen into sort of subsections of the document. So there was another kind of document a while ago called a page description diagram, where you kind of define all the modules that go into a page, say if it's a web page.
Yeah.
And I remember making a lot of these kinds of things where we showed like all of the different kinds of ways data change within a module. So we kind of do that sometimes, where we'll design the core, the skeleton of the UI, and then we'll sort of break out the module and flesh out the user interaction for that module within like the side or the margin of the wireframe. And it's sort of like having little pieces of a larger system that you can then visualize, you know, falling into place in the little blocks within the UI. So that's how I tend to use them. And then there's a lot of arrows and annotation that just sort of help to describe the story for the developer that takes it from there and then turns it into something functional.
I can imagine that this is a really useful tool for developers, you know, where they can easily see how everything interrelates to one another, that rather than just kind of throwing a load of static screens over the wall to them.
Yeah, and it sort of strikes the right balance. I mean, they need enough information that so the abstractness of words can, you know, leaves... Mm. You know, it's more specific so that they know what to build, but it's not overly complex or sophisticated that we spend too much time, invest too much time in it. So it's just kind of like the sweet spot for us.
I like the sound of it a lot. So if you want to know more about web flows, we will put a link to an article on the Balsamic website in the show notes. But other than that, thank you very much, Michael, joining us, and hopefully we'll get to speak to you again soon.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Well, that just blew my brains. I've never heard anything so revolutionary before.
Oh, dear. I don't know what to say, because it'll just sound silly whatever I say.
I'm actually Googling it.
Well, I thought of that, I thought it could mean it's probably something to do with volcanoes or something, isn't it? I don't know.
No, it's basically, from what I'm seeing here, it's like a combination of a user flow diagram and a wireframe.
Okay.
So yeah, you're right, really. It's like a series of illustrations where you show how one wireframe relates to the next one.
Okay, so kind of like a website storyboard, something like that.
Yes, I like that idea.
You can use
it. That's a nice way of putting it.
Old you can use that, or future you. I'm getting so confused now.
It's very confusing, isn't it? Yeah. So anyway, that was really good, because now we've been introduced to a new thing. You know, you'd think after 25 years of doing this, I would know all of the cool, terminology and stuff. But, you know, it's always new stuff coming along. Anyway, that about wraps up this week's show. I'm going to set you some homework, which is I want you to try before the next show, which is in a month's time, to run a stakeholder wireframing workshop. Give it a go. See how you get on. You know, pick either Lee's approach or my approach and see what happens. Because I think you'll be pleasantly surprised that it's actually a very useful tool if you're not already doing it. Next time, we're going to look at higher fidelity prototyping. So we're going to look at taking our wireframes to the next level, doing a little bit more detail. That's going to be out on the 1st of October. Mm-hmm. But until then, all we need to do to finish off the show is Marcus's joke.
Well, this one's from Ian at Headscape. So double helpings of Headscape this week. Right, here we go. I was watching an Australian cookery show and the audience clapped when the chef made meringue. I was surprised, as Australians usually boomerang.
I could see it coming, but I couldn't quite get there before you got the line out. I think you've just undermined Headscape's credibility with that. So we had Lee build it up, and then Ian's just devastated it again. So there we go. Such is life. All right. So thank you very much for joining us for this show. Hopefully you found it useful. We're going to talk again on the 1st of October. And just remind you to sign up to the Borough Guild newsletter at boroughguild.com/subscribe. Bye.